When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. It's a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm talking to Egle Rinzevirtuta about the will to predict, orchestrating the future through science. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Dave. It's nice to be here.
This is a genuinely incredible book. It's absolutely fascinating, both in terms of its subject matter, in terms of the kind of story it's trying to tell, but also, and we might sort of get into this later on in the podcast, about what it might tell us about kind of how we live, you know, right now in the modern world. And I suppose all good kind of history and sort of cultural studies of history and histories of science and technologies are like that. They've got that historical and that contemporary element. But I guess given that it's such a kind of fascinating subject, I'm intrigued to know sort of where you got the idea that you'd write a book about the history of scientific predictions within Soviet Russia. Was that part of your kind of broader research agenda, or was it just something, you know, that kind of came to you as this is a great idea?
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you for your generous words about the book. Indeed, the very idea to write this book came from... it is, of course, rooted in my past research, and I will say a few more words about it. But really, I became increasingly interested in this very problem of predictability. So now you see it everywhere, you know, in the public debate, that the world is becoming unpredictable, that we are facing global climate crisis, you know, that there are all these limits to imagination of where the world is going to. There is increasingly challenging pressures in terms of social and political and economic insecurity. And there was kind of thinking that both social imagination and contemporary science are somehow less able to see what is going to happen in the future. And the world prediction or inability to predict is thrown into this debate very often. So I became intrigued. So what does it really mean to predict and to predict scientifically? How scientific predictions are different from any other, you know, attempts to imagine, to conjecture future events? So that was kind of, so to speak, real life motivation to look into this concept. But otherwise, I was working for the last couple of decades on the history of scientific expertise and how it is used in public policy and government. And I'm particularly interested in the role of scientific expertise in the context where institutions are trying to liberalize and democratize themselves. So this is why I've been working mainly with East European case studies, particularly the Soviet communist institutions, in the early and mid 20th century, but also in the post-Soviet period. I'm very much interested in the role of science and scientific knowledge in arranging political and social relations. And so, you know, the very project of Western modernity has been theorized as an attempt to rationalize the present and the future, and as an attempt to, likewise, to know the future, to predict the future. And in the years 2012 and 2015, I was lucky to work with Professor Jenny Anderson at Sciences Po in Paris on the FuturePol project, where Anderson was looking at the political history of the future. So again, there are now so many studies about, you know, the intellectual history, the sociology, kind of institutional analysis of future expertise, you know, economic predictions, social predictions, even political predictions, environmental predictions. It's like a growing field. But what does it really mean to predict? It's not always quite clear. So what I try to do with this book is to bring some more clarity to the debate and to trace the development of scientific prediction throughout history, with a focus on, well, as you say, Soviet Russian, but really on European cases. So it's not an attempt to look how prediction developed globally in non-European contexts. It's really focused on the European context, and that's an important limitation. So indeed, so the book originated from, you know, this observation that not enough attention has been paid to prediction. When I started, and initially I thought maybe it will be either a chapter or a small book, but the more I started to look into the history of prediction, you know, the more was coming up. And in the end, I wrote this book as a wider argument to call for something that could be, you know, seen as the studies of prediction or prediction studies, similar to risk studies. So we have a huge and a very interesting area of interdisciplinary risk studies, where risks are analyzed from technical, cultural, political perspectives. And I think that it is time to do the same with prediction. So in order to really have a well-informed and competent academic, but also public discussion about the future, we really need to have a better literacy about scientific prediction in a similar way to the understanding of risk.
I mean, one thing the book tries to do is explain what scientific prediction actually is, both in terms of kind of practical application. Maybe it's, I mean, evolution's the wrong word, isn't it? Because that's got a certain kind of teleological element to it. But there is a kind of sense of the way scientific prediction has developed and been given different forms of both social status, application, and content. So how does the book kind of define it? What are we talking about when we're talking about scientific prediction?
Yeah, absolutely. So the history of scientific prediction, of course, is the history of knowledge. And what does it mean to understand reality? Is it possible to understand reality? Are we living in some sort of matrix, right? Do we construct reality and fool ourselves that we have some sort of objective instruments for understanding? So prediction is really, really interesting. And first of all, I have to say that there are very interesting comparative studies of pre-modern prediction in European Chinese and other contexts. But I was looking mainly in the European context, so that's really, really important to say. And this is because the existing approaches to prediction in contemporary public policy and science are really very much Eurocentric. So that's both problematic, but that's how it is. So I was tracking the history of European scientific prediction. And so one can see that the very first notions of prediction in Europe have been articulated in ancient Greek and Roman philosophical treatises. And very important distinctions were made at that time to differentiate between two types of knowledge. And one type of human knowledge was called scientia, the knowledge that looks into causes. So what are the causes of all these different events or phenomena which are observed? And other type of knowledge was looking more at science, kind of, you know, not for causes, but for meanings. And those of you who are kind of well-versed in the philosophy of science, that connects very clearly to current debates about explanation versus interpretation, right? So this is where it's coming from. So now what is really interesting is that in this classical period, the only reliable sciences were those which were able to identify clear causes. So this would be geometry, mathematics, physics, mechanics. Because we were studying forms of reality which appeared quite regular and quite systematic. But such things as, you know, the weather or human health or political events, dealing with fast changes, irreversible changes, apparently really not quite chaotic, not systematic forms of reality, they couldn't be, were causes were not possible to identify. So those forms of reality were studied, were kind of a domain of mantic knowledge. And so prediction emerged as part of mantic knowledge. So science, according to this view, was trying to find certainty and causes, whilst predictive knowledge was trying to track, to get some sense of this fast, of those fast changing events, of very unstable realities, and to make guesses or conjectures about what might possibly happen, right? And this is really, really interesting. So this, I'm also in one chapter, I'm trying to show how prediction or how this mantic knowledge is eventually were incorporated in the arsenal of modern science. So that happened in the 17th and 18th century when the attempt to predict and to address irregular forms of reality became a task for all sciences indeed. And one can see that, you know, kind of I'm really fast tracking now through centuries. So the scientific ambition grew, and what we have even with contemporary science is an attempt to understand all sorts of extremely fast changing, very complex processes at both very kind of micro level, like in quantum mechanics, to very macro level, like the studies of the universe, but also all sorts of changing genetic, psychoneurological, biological realities, but also complex social events. So, for instance, how do can human behavior be predicted? Can collective human behavior be predicted? Can we predict future wars? Can we predict the outcomes of present wars? So all those kind of forms of reality where it is very difficult to identify clear causes, they wouldn't categorize as suitable for the form of knowledge as this classical scientia, but they require this particular specific, little bit imperfect knowledge, which is predictive. So this is this basic categorization that I try to unpack in my book.
I mean, if that's a sort of quite high level, I guess, kind of abstract framing of the meaning of scientific prediction and perhaps some of its kind of developments, maybe we could give a few examples of how that understanding plays out in practice. And obviously, you know, Russia and Soviet Russia in particular is the case study. And maybe we'll take sort of three or four examples that are in the book. The first one, I guess, which is the one that listeners are probably kind of most familiar with, will be the idea of sort of statistical forecasting, particularly in the context of things like economic policy, and I guess bits of kind of social policy that intersect with planning in the kind of classic Soviet model. So what's that kind of early history of that sort of forecasting in Russia and in the Soviet state.
Yeah, absolutely. So in Russia, or even the Russian Empire of late 16th, early 17th and 18th centuries, the problems that the country was facing was pretty similar to any other states, really, in Europe. It was the problem of population and natural resources. And there was this increasing ambition developing to account for population and natural resources and the emerging economy in scientific ways. And to do that, initially, very kind of basic methods of kind of financial accounting were done to work out basically what is the scope of trade and what sort of taxation system is in place and what kind of national income the state has. And there are lots of histories of the development of the political economy of European states, which are looking into those periods and those processes. So what I'm trying to do in my book, and which I find really interesting, is the intensification of those attempts in the late 18th and 19th centuries. And this is when the discipline of mathematics was introduced in the Russian Empire. So when French and Swiss mathematicians traveled to St. Petersburg to establish the first mathematical departments. And in doing that, they brought statistical methods of forecasting. The only problem in the 18th century with mathematical forecasting or like projecting statistical data into the future was that we didn't have enough data. So the whole 19th century in the Russian Empire could be regarded as a foundational period when population level statistics was incrementally accumulated. And it's very interesting. This gathering of data was connected through the development of lots of public institutions, such as public hygiene, the military, but also meteorological institutions, meteorological forecasting, which was intrinsically linked with the needs of agriculture, but also prospection of natural resources like mining, and so on. So this data was eventually emerging. It was such a slow process, and this is something that I try to really highlight in my book. And the big difference between the Russian Empire and Western European countries was that population statistics in the West, in the 18th and 19th century, were primarily collected to solve the so-called urban problem. It was like a response to increasing urbanization and social unrest and migration from rural to urban areas. Whilst in the Russian Empire, we didn't have that problem. It was still mainly agricultural society. But it's interesting to look back into this genealogy of scientific forecasting, which today we see, you know, through the all sorts of algorithmic applications, and to be aware just how tightly it was connected with agriculture science and trade and agricultural economy. So in Russia, you see really a lot of that. And then with the communist revolution in 1917-1918, when the communist government embarked on modernizing Russia, then a whole range of state planning institutions were established to collect more data about the population, about the economy, about the natural resources, to construct genuinely modern urban industrial economy. And so one can see that, that's why the book is called The Will to Predict. The will to forecast was there in the 18th century, but the possibilities to do that were not there because of the shortage of data. The will to forecast scientifically in the Russian Empire, but also elsewhere, and then in the communist Russia, became extremely acute in the first half of the 20th century, and particularly in between two world wars, because it was economically such a turbulent and insecure period. But again, data was being collected, but it was still not fully there. So what we today understand as, you know, this kind of the practice of forecasting as fairly routine, and, you know, we can read thousands of forecasts every day and we are more or less reliable. So this comes into being only in the 1950s and 60s. And so, yeah, that's what I try to show in my book, this very long and incremental history of forecasting and how it was, what were the factors that stimulated government's interest in the practice of forecasting, but also what were the limitations and institutional constraints for doing that?
The book is also full of some quite fascinating and quite problematic characters, as well as being, I suppose, a more kind of macro history and sort of slightly later on in the chronological story are a couple of key, I guess, kind of management gurus in the, I suppose, kind of modern sense. And I wonder if you could introduce one of those and basically kind of give a sense of the story of the move, I suppose, from that kind of planning forecasting into the idea of Russia having a sort of management science.
Yeah, absolutely. So the problem with the Soviet Russia and the Soviet Union was that although the regime might kind of to be based on the scientific foundation was the ideology. So there was a very strong political will to use to deploy science for making policy decisions and to fund scientific research relevant for all sorts of areas like the economy, society, building infrastructure, culture. The irony, or rather the tragedy, was that because of the domination of communist, of the Soviet Communist Party, the actual possibilities to do proper science were sometimes severely limited and sometimes strange, to say the least. So what I try to show in my book is how particular communities, one can see scientific or epistemological communities, emerged in this very uneasy authoritarian context and tried to do what they saw as proper science about the future, to create predictive knowledge regardless of all sorts of political and social difficulties that they had. And so indeed, many chapters focus on distinct figures which were quite foundational for the fields. And in my view, they were also really original and creative thinkers. So they deserve a place in the context of wider history of by the intellectual history of governance and management and organization. So the first person whom I would like to mention, and he's really known internationally, but probably mainly among economists, and this is Nikolai Kondratyev, one of the first Russian sociologists, professional sociologists, who was born in 1892, and he died tragically in 1938, executed by Stalin. And Nikolai Kondratyev was charged to precisely build institutions to collect population level data and national economic data in order to create forecasts of the future of the Soviet economy. So Kondratyev established such an institute in the 1920s, and he was supposed to inform the famous or notorious Soviet five-year plans. However, Kondratyev, as a genuinely committed scientist, he immediately resisted that kind of request from the government, saying that the discipline of economics just simply wasn't ready. There was not enough data. There was not enough sufficient mathematical methodology to forecast with any certainty, you know, the development of Soviet economy in 5, 10, or 20 years. And that was a very unpopular thing to say, as you can imagine. But what's interesting is that Kondratyev developed his own theory of business cycles. It was not entirely original. Similar theories or models were also developed in Germany and in the United States, particularly. But his particular model has survived, and it's still used by economists. It's known as Kondratyev waves. And his argument is that economic growth goes in 40 to 60 years cycles of boom and bust. And those are determined by infrastructural, but also all sorts of economic factors. So that's kind of interesting. So although Kondratyev was executed in the 1930s as part of Stalin's crackdown on really independent scientific thinking, his ideas lived on. And if you look, you will find lots of debates today that now in 2020 we are at the bottom of Kondratyev's wave. And if you use his model, we are looking into another 5 or 10 years of misery. So it's a very, very interesting figure. And to me, Kondratyev is a symbol of developing predictive knowledge as a way to critique political initiatives, to push through certain reforms and attempts to co-opt statistics and science just to support those political projects rather than to really be informed by the scientific expertise. Another character or figure that you have mentioned is the really very influential Soviet management guru. I think we can really use this word, Georgi Shadrovitsky. So Georgi Shadrovitsky is a completely different person from Kondratyev. He was born in 1929 and died in 1994. And most of his career unfolded in the 1960s, 70s, and the 80s. And so his work coincides with the late Soviet period after World War II. And the situation, the context in which Shadrovitsky worked was very different from Kondratyev. So if Kondratyev was facing, one can say, like an institutional desert, he had to establish predictive knowledge building institutions like almost from the scratch. Shadrovitsky was already born into a very extensive and extremely bureaucratized Soviet institutional apparatus. So for people, maybe it's difficult to imagine, but in the Soviet Union, research infrastructure was extremely kind of blown up. It was huge. So there were zillions of administrations and zillions of research institutes employing thousands of researchers and bureaucrats and administrators. And that was all the result of a highly centralized process of planning. So there was lots of bureaucracy. And administrative bureaucracy, which was extremely ineffective. And many scholars argue that partially why the Soviet Union collapsed was because of this stifling impact of excessive bureaucratization. So Shadrovitsky, he was trained as a philosopher. He became interested in also in psychology and cognitive psychology and psychology of learning. And basically when facing this extremely politicized and profoundly administered Soviet reality and how it was inefficient and how it didn't work, Shadrovitsky became kind of curious how this could be changed and could people self-organize outside this, you know, Weberian bureaucratic cage. The destiny of Shadrovitsky is also interesting. He was very much an elite scholar. He was born In Odessa, but he grew up in Moscow, part of a very highly educated, very well-connected family. He went to top universities. He even taught in prestigious institutes, but he kind of fell, he was repressed in the late 60s because he supported several dissident philosophers who were his friends. So he himself wasn't dissident, but he was loyal to his friends. And therefore, he couldn't really continue his academic career as a philosopher throughout the 70s and 80s. But what he did, he sought shelter in the institutes of design and management. And that turned out to be a very conducive environment for him to develop his ideas about organization of human behavior outside of administrative context. And so Shadrovsky came up with the idea of reflexive prospective reflexivity. And this is really interesting. Again, maybe he's not 100% original, but the way he articulated his theory is really interesting. So many of you would be familiar with the idea of reflection. So when we think about reflexive modernity or Western subjectivities, it's something key for any individual mind to reflect upon itself, right? Or for people to make sense of a situation, we do that by reflecting on what happened in the past. So the very concept of reflexivity normally is directed internally and to the past. So what Shadrovsky did, he said, look, but reflexivity is also directed into the future. It's about projecting self into the future. And the future is never individual. The future is always collective because individuals are always part of behavioral and interactive networks. So he started to develop a super complicated cognitive theory, trying to formalize and to describe also mathematically this process in which people project their own identity and behavior into the future. And he also wanted to make that theory not just descriptive or normative, but practical. So in relation to that, he created an entire set of what he called methodology of facilitating management and organization activities by training managers and teams in different contexts. These could be enterprises, these could be local government institutions. So basically teaching people to be, to engage with future reflexively and collectively. And that method became known as kind of methodological circle. And in the 1980s, there was such a huge demand in the Soviet Union, really just to do something because management was dysfunctional. The economy was declining. There was a huge need to build a massive infrastructure like nuclear power plants, gas extraction, oil extraction, all sorts of very complex chemical processing facilities, not to speak about, building apartments for people to live in. And all those construction projects were delayed by years and years. So today we can think, about HS2 and how it is delayed and its cost is spiraling. So in the Soviet Union, it was similar that everything was continuously delayed. And when something really interesting happens, so although Shadrovsky was not, he was kind of politically stained, but the demand to do something about those impossible delays in building infrastructure was so grave that he was invited to consult, for example, the building of Beloyarsk nuclear power plant, developing integrated industrial systems in East Siberia, developing urban development in Riga, large growing city. So he spent the 1980s touring the entire Soviet Union and disseminating his approach. And although he died in 1994, his son Piotr Shadrovitsky continued his work. And Piotr Shadrovitsky was actually the first, he pioneered cultural policy research in post-Soviet Russia. He established a cultural policy studies institute in the 90s. And he continued doing the same as Georgi, his father. So he traveled now all around Russia, helping local authorities and regional governors to create the cultural strategies, and he used Shadrovitsky's prospective reflexivity methodology in doing that. There is just additional complication to that, if you are interested. So it became controversial recently, especially with Russia's invasion of Crimea and Russia's war in Ukraine, and Putin's use of the idea of the Russian world, or Ruskiy Mir, the Russian Mir, as an ideological idea justifying that Russia can claim its interests anywhere around the world where Russian-speaking people live. And the very idea of this Russian world as having no boundaries and being somehow integrated as a prospective reflexive collective was proposed by the same Piotr Shadrovitsky and his colleagues in the late 90s and early 2000s. So today, Piotr is, of course, distancing himself from Putin and the specific use of this concept. But it also has to be said that very many high politicians and functionaries in Putin's regime, they went through those management schools in Shadrovitsky's tradition. So they sort of form their own network. So there's this kind of mind-boggling history where when a completely intellectual idea gets translated into practice and it leads to creation of very particular policy and political communities that I try to unpack in my book.
I mean, that's just one example, and the book is packed with an incredibly kind of rich range of these, both, I guess, kind of individual characters and also kind of broader histories and broader narratives. We've sort of scratched the surface of the book, and obviously there's so much more we could have talked about. You sort of alluded, you mentioned in the British context, this attempt to build a new railway line that has been like an absolute disaster from sort of start to finish, really. And I wonder, as a kind of like concluding question, I could get you to reflect on the meaning of the book for kind of contemporary readers, you know, for the kind of contemporary world. Are there any lessons that the book has to teach us?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the reasons why so much of my research looks into the non-Western European cases is because I find them absolutely fascinating. And that history, I think, is just purely so interesting. But there are more general things, as you see, more general lessons that can be learned. And sometimes looking outside of Western context, we can see those lessons in many ways maybe more clearly, because the political and social context of a way in which predictive expertise was used in the Soviet and Russian context is just so dysfunctional. But it also makes scientific prediction to stand out really very, very clearly. It looks less mundane, so to speak. I guess one of the reasons why we haven't looked so much into scientific prediction before is because they are just everywhere. You know, they're almost like common sense. They are hard to spot. But in the Soviet context, scientists really had to fought to develop that form of knowledge, because it had a very, very strong potential to critique the political regime. So I guess the main lesson is that we really need a one can say an epistemological literacy as part of educating our managers, policymakers, and the decision makers who use scientific expertise, all sorts of research reports, who work with data, who need data for their day-to-day decisions. And the reason for that is that it seems like we kind of, from the common sense perspective, we think we know what scientific predictions are about. It's information about the future, right? About what will happen. But it's not. And that's what I try to show in the book. Scientific predictions are not about what will happen in the future. It's about organizing the very production of knowledge in a very particular and continuous way. And it's a way of living with complexity and uncertainty. So the difference between prediction and a scientific fact is that predictions always carry a high degree of uncertainty with them. And basically what happens is that once scientists or researchers produce some sort of forecasts or projections or predictions about the future, and when they do not get fulfilled, if you do not understand how scientific predictions work, then you might think, oh, but we are rubbish scientists. You know, last time we predicted this, it hasn't happened. Why should they listen to them again? And we had that debate very strongly manifest during COVID, the beginning of COVID pandemic, you might remember. And that was actually when I was finalizing my book. So it was incredibly interesting to see the whole kind of public debate and questioning of predictions to unfold. So in terms of climate change, again, so the level of prediction and predictability. What can be predicted with what degree of certainty? Can predictions of how the change in temperature and atmospheric movement and water and land, how will that impact very particular places? Can we have those very precise predictions? And can we have those precise predictions about long-term, many years to come? So we can have fairly good weather prediction for the next 1 or 2 days, we can have some general idea of how the weather might look in a year from now, but can we tell it with great certainty about what will happen in 10, 20, or 30 years? The problem is that when you plan infrastructure and when you plan investments at the national and international levels, you do want to have that information, right? But the problem is that you can't plan economy for more than 30 years because, again, the economic models, because of discounting, the value, the current monetary value disappears. It becomes zero in 30 years because of inflation. So what I'm trying to say is that being aware about the levels of complexity and the technicalities of scientific predictions and those predictive models would help to align expectations of what is the value of predictive scientific expertise. So the problem becomes, expressed most clearly when policymakers, we have some sort of almost astrological expectations from scholars, So please do this research project and tell us what will happen. And so then, so that decision makers in their full confidence could take some sort of action. So it doesn't work like that. And while at public policy level, that's kind of acknowledged and we have so many science and research advisors, when it comes to public education, public engagement, there is a huge gap in understanding how predictive knowledge works. And filling this gap is really important for a number of reasons. So one of them would be, you know, kind of generating public trust and understanding of science in relation to environmental and climate crisis, but also you know, it would help people plan their future finances, their future pensions. Maybe it would help them to respond to economic crisis in a way that is less frustrating. So there are lots of kind of practical implications. As a sociologist and historian, of course, I'm most interested in intellectual implications because it's just so fascinating. But I could see about a lot of public value in increasing literacy and prediction as well.
And do you think a future book in this, or are you going to be working and writing on different subjects?
Yeah, absolutely. So I would love to work more looking at how scientific prediction evolves in relation to the onset of artificial intelligence. And we didn't have time this time to talk more about cybernetics. I pay quite a lot of attention to cybernetics in my book, which is like prehistory of AI, looking at predicting behaviors in extreme short term. And this is what all those clever algorithmic applications are doing today. So it's really interesting how this algorithmic prediction as a technology is going to scale up and in what context and what it will do to popular understanding of prediction. And maybe it will generate a new model of scientific prediction. I don't know. So I would be very much interested in exploring that. But in addition to that, I'm also working on predicting the future of radioactive waste and nuclear facilities. So again, in relation to ongoing energy crisis, there is renewed debate about kind of nuclear renaissance and renuclearizing energy systems in Europe, possibly even in the US. But the problem with the nuclear energy systems is that they generate a lot of radioactive waste, which will stay extremely hazardous for tens, if not hundreds of thousands of years. So how do you manage those extremely hazardous materials, which are not stationary, which are also evolving and changing safely? How do you guarantee the security in this extreme long term? So I do hope to connect my insights into the epistemology of prediction, management, policy making, but also this very complex materiality of nuclear waste in my next book, hopefully.